Ooh, I feel so blessed. You know, the warmth and the love and the laughter that I felt the minute I arrived. And I love the see and share, because I do believe that the sharing of the love is the important part. And you know, I've learned a little bit in the program that I think listening is the greatest way to share your love. And I appreciate you being willing to give me that gift this afternoon. My name is Stephanie, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. In Texas, they say things like, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, and they say, you know, by the grace of God, the principles of the program, and this loving fellowship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, one time I was thinking, so what would I say as an Al-Anon? Okay. By the grace of God, the principles of the program, and this loving fellowship, I have not found it necessary to be responsible for things that are not my responsibility since August the 17th of 2001. I was apologizing for a plane being delayed. I kept going, it's not my fault, it's not my fault. But I felt so responsible for the rain in Dallas. And I just know that's not true. I want to thank Jerry and Jeanette. What beautiful hostesses. And the phone calls from Jerry periodically. And just the being willing to have me come and giving me this opportunity. I'm really grateful and I thank you. And I guess I need to thank Lee, too, because he sat at the airport and waited the 2.5 hours yesterday for my plane with Jerry and Jeanette. They ate. I didn't. I had a resentment. They didn't. And I appreciate Joan so much. I have gotten to know her, and she's really big into Al-Anon service, and I admire that. I consider that a great way of showing your love for the program, and I thank you, Joan. And the committee provided this beautiful vase for me in my room when I got here yesterday, and a lovely card. Now, I'm just assuming that there will be fresh flowers sent to my house periodically to fill the vase. I mean, it was empty when I got it, but you know, I just kind of thought maybe that would be the "and there will be" part of it all. I feel so grateful to have this opportunity. And our literature suggests, now don't you love that word suggest? You know, it's like, if you don't, you die. But, you know, but we only suggest that you share, and this is what it says in the Al-Anon literature, how sick you were, how well you are, and what helped you to get well, with the emphasis being on what helped you to get well. So I'm going to try to do that today. I was born December the 24th, 1944. That makes me 56 years old. I was born in Midland, Texas, the oldest of three children, and born into an Italian Catholic family. Now, it was explained to me that if you hung around somebody that was Italian, Catholic, Capricorn, untreated Al-Anon, you would find it necessary to drink also. I'm even responsible for that. When we get in the program, they suggest that we look to see, how did we get here? You know, what was it? It was also explained to me that healthy people don't marry sick people. And so I had to go back, because I had been sharing all along that I am fine, I'm the one that's doing okay, it's the alcoholic, you know, and I just kept doing this kind of thing, if only he would. And then when I got here, you said, it's a family disease and we need to turn around and look at ourselves. And so I started looking at the home in which I was raised. Now, being a Catholic, the message that I got, and I don't know if it came from Mom and Dad or if it came from the church, but what the message I got was, if you did good, you got good. And if you did bad, you better watch out. So I was a very good little girl. I was scared to death all the time. I was so afraid something terrible was going to happen to me if I just crossed over that line. So I didn't. Whatever my parents said, I believed them, and I followed through. You ask my mom, I'm not telling you anything that's not true. And that's how I lived my life. I also had some other messages about, we are fine. Everything's fine. You're going to be fine. There were never any feelings shared, expressed, and validated. And one of the things that I think was so detrimental to me was that I saw my mother and father have one argument in the 18 years that I lived at home. And my mama cried, walked out, slammed the door, got in the car, and drove off. So I never saw anger expressed appropriately or resolved, so I also lived in fear of anger. Bill and I were married for a couple of months, and we had an argument, and so I cried, walked out, slammed the door, got in the car, and drove off. I'd never remembered as a child how that story ended for my mom and dad. It ended for me, and I almost ran out of gas because he never came looking for me. And when I came home, he was asleep on the couch, and so that didn't work. But really, in my family, nobody said it's okay to be scared, it's okay to be angry, it's okay to be lonely. I mean, we never shared any of those feelings. And I think that creates a healthy environment. My daddy was also a workaholic, and my mother was raised in a family where, we don't talk about it being alcoholism, but she's had several brothers die from having a drinking problem. And so my mom would be what I would call an untreated Al-Anon. Now, I know that we hear a lot of people refer to Al-Anons as people that just kind of hang out with alcoholics. That's just not true. You are an Al-Anon if you go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps, read the literature. You are an untreated Al-Anon if you hang out with alcoholics and don't attend any meetings. My mom is today an untreated Al-Anon. And I do believe that there's alcoholism in her family, but that's only my opinion. And I don't share that with her because she doesn't believe that to be true. And I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. It has no bearing on how I am and where I am today, except to give me a little bit of the insight as to this is what was modeled for me and this is what I picked up on. You know, if somebody had said, this is how you need to do a healthy home, I would have done it. But I watched Mom and Dad, and that's what I did. And today, I'm grateful that I have a choice to do it differently. And so, I also, growing up, looked at you, and you looked so put together and so perfect. And I judged your outsides by my insides, and I never felt like I was enough. When Libba was talking last night about the hole in her tummy, I could identify with that. There's this little void where I never felt quite good enough. And as I was listening to Libba last night, I thought, you know what? She wants to be a lady, and by golly, she is. And I'm grateful that today she's my new friend. The feelings that she even talked about last night, I'm sitting there going like this. And so I think the difference is Libba drank. I just found somebody to attach myself to, you know, and that's what I did. We have an obsession, and my obsession just happens to be people, places and things, and I think it's okay for us to know that we do have the same disease. It just seems we have different ways of what we think is a solution for us. My husband and I met when we were seniors in high school, and we dated for 4.5 years before we were married. Bill was not drinking at the time. After I was born in Midland, my family moved to San Antonio, and that's where I grew up. And so we met as seniors. He went to college at the University of Texas, and I went to Southwest Texas in San Marcos. And then after we both graduated, we married. And we lived in Austin. And I had gone to college to be a school teacher, and that's what I loved doing. I loved teaching. And I was grateful to be able to do that. And I'm just kind of skipping along, except that I'm noticing that on weekends, Butler's drinking a few beers here and there. And, you know, my family's social drinkers. My parents don't drink alcoholically. You know, once every 6 months, they'll go to a party and have a couple of drinks, and they are not alcoholics themselves. But so I don't know what to do with all this booze that I'm watching come in and go out, and it seems to be progressing a little bit. But, you know, I'm just kind of conscious of it, and I don't see it causing any real problems, so I think we're doing okay. And 3 years after we were married, I became pregnant, and in August of 69, right before our baby was born, one of my Italian cousins had a big wedding in San Antonio. And Austin's about an hour north of San Antonio, so Bill and I drove back to this Catholic Italian wedding. And it's just early Saturday morning, and it's a beautiful wedding, and they're so glad to see me pregnant. You know how those Italians are. Oh, yeah, she's going to have a baby. And I was so proud to be pregnant, and, you know, it was just a grand time. And, you know, after we had the wedding, we went out to the airport, and we're drinking the champagne, and my cousin and his new bride are going to fly to Hawaii. So we're walking around the airport, and people are coming up to me, my relatives, and saying, you know, Bill is so much fun.
Well, Bill's an only child, and Bill doesn't like big family gatherings. And I'm thinking, he is? And then somebody else would say, we're having a great time with your husband. He is just delightful. He is? You know, and but I, oh, that's good. You know, he's finally deciding to get with it, you know. We've been together now, what, 7.5 years? It's about time for him to kind of get with it. So I'm thinking this is all good news. And right before the plane leaves, Bill comes up and whispers in my ear. He says, I'll be back in just a minute. And I said, okay. So we wave goodbye to the plane, and, it, you know, the kid, they fly off, and everybody starts to leave the airport, and everybody's ready to go. And, you know, we're going, so where's Bill? And we couldn't find him. And we had him paged, and we went out to the car, and we walked up and down. And finally, my brother-in-law went into the men's room, and my husband had passed out on the john. And we had to get the attendant of the airport to take the door off of the hinges, and we had to get a wheelchair, and we had to pull up his britches and put him in this wheelchair and then push him out. Now, my brother-in-law says, I will be happy to push this wheelchair. And I said, no, he's my husband. I will push the wheelchair. I am 9 months pregnant, and I am insisting on pushing this wheelchair, and Butler's sliding out, and we're pushing him back up, and he's sliding out. And my mother is saying, my son-in-law is drunk. And I said, no, he's not. He's sick. And I did that for 19 years. No, he's not. He's sick. Bless his heart. You know, and it's true. I insisted that there was nothing wrong with him. And he'd slide out and we'd push him back in. And we just did this all the way. You know, and we get to the curb and the cop says, may I help you? And my mother says, my son-in-law is drunk. And I said, no, he's not. He's just sick. And I need to tell you, 19 years later, when I realized that he had a drinking problem, I went to a psychiatrist, and I said, do you think my husband could have a brain tumor? And he said, no, I think your husband's an alcoholic. It would have been better for me for him to have had a brain tumor. And let's remove it and get on with our lives. And, you know, the denial, oh, my goodness. We wonder sometimes why people don't get here, and I think the denial is so strong. And that was the beginning of mine. During the month of August in 1969, a really beautiful little girl was born, and her name is Laura. And I was thrilled to death, loved. I'd gotten to teach for 3 years, and now I was going to be a mommy, and that's all I ever wanted to do. And 21 months later, Wes was born. So we have what I consider to be the perfect family, a little girl, a little boy, everything's great. And I am so happy. I just consider, you know, it's just like, this is wonderful. But my idea of love was an enmeshment. And everywhere Butler went, that's where we went. If he went hunting, we went hunting. If he went fishing, we went fishing. I mean, and I thought that if you were together, you showed your love for each other. But that hole that I had talked about earlier never really got filled. You know, it was always, I was waiting for him to make me happy. And I was feeling so responsible for everything. I volunteered. I was in the PTA and the Brownies. And, you know, I just did service work. I was just doing whatever I could to try to get the hole filled up. And when Bill would come home from work, I would expect him to fill the hole. And his drinking was progressing, you know, and I could see that. But it wasn't anything terrible. I was just kind of watching it, monitoring it, talking to him about it from time to time. But there were no catastrophes. He never got a DWI. He just, you know, we just went along our way. Now I need to tell you a little story also that will help you see the dynamics of our family. We had a border collie, and Flopsy was just wonderful. And we've never seen the birth of puppies, but Flopsy was pregnant. And so our kids are young, and we're excited we're going to have a litter of puppies. And so I decided to shampoo her. And so I shampooed her, and we're all, you know, waiting for the puppies to be born. But as I was getting ready to dry her off, I looked at the bottle, and it says, do not use on pregnant dogs. Oh, my gosh. So I called the vet. Dr. Pigott, what have I done? And he said, well, Stephanie, you know, you've got a couple of weeks before the puppies are born. Let's just wait and see. I said, okay. So we waited, and sure enough, 2 weeks later, Flopsy has her first puppy, and it's born dead. And so I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, oh, my gosh, I have killed these puppies. And he said, no, there's a lot in there. Let's just wait and see what happens. So about 2 hours later, another puppy was born, and it was born alive. So I called Dr. Pigott and said, Dr. Pigott, we have a healthy puppy. It's alive. He said, I'm really happy for you. And so then about an hour later, Flopsy had another puppy, and it was okay. So I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, Dr. Pigott, we're doing okay. We've had another puppy, and she's alive, and, you know, and he's going, that's really good, Stephanie. We're really, you know. And so throughout the day, Flopsy had seven puppies. And I called Dr. Pigott after each puppy. And the last puppy was born, and it was a tiny little thing. And so I called and said, Dr. Pigott, we've got a puppy, and he's having trouble breathing, and I don't know what to do for him. And he said, do you have any alcohol in your home? Yes. And he said, well, put a little bit on the tip of a teaspoon and put it in the puppy's mouth and just kind of work it down her throat. And I said, okay, I can do that. And then he said, and then, Stephanie, I want you to sit down and drink the rest of that bottle. It's a true story. He really said that. And I thought, oh, if I could, I would. I'm so tired. You know, I've been trying to do all of these things, keep the family together and do the service work and be a good wife and take care of these children. And I had a sign in front of our house that said, we're very happy. Thank you very much, you know. And it just wasn't true. And we had a daughter who was growing up at this time. And Laura, who I just adore today, at the time, we called her the daughter from hell. But she was growing up, and she, you know, Laura was a teenager, and she was doing her thing, and I was just trying so hard to get her to mind her manners and do the right thing, and she was just doing the acting out. And if there was a rule laid down, Laura found a way to break it. And so Bill and I were at this time, of course, his drinking is progressing, and I'm worried about that, and Laura's doing her acting out, and Wesley's just doing his little thing. He just wants to please his mama. And when Laura, at one point, Bill and I said, you know, we're going to go get her fixed. She's the problem. And so we took her to a doctor, and a psychologist, and we said, fix this kid. And he spent some time with me, and then he spent some time with Bill, and then he spent some time with Laura, and then he came back to us, and he said, I need to tell you that of the three of you, your daughter is the healthiest. Of course, Laura's reaction was, yes, you know. Bill didn't want to pay the guy. But, you know, and he explained to us, she expresses her feelings. She does it inappropriately, but she expresses her feelings. We're going around saying everything's fine. I am living with a practicing alcoholic. Every day I am watching things get a little bit worse in our family and in our relationships, and, you know, but we're fine. And Laura's the one going, no, we're not. No, we're not. You know, somebody pay attention. And the only way she could do it was by doing this kind of stuff. And the more she did it, the more angrier I got. And I never learned how to express my feelings to Bill. I never could say to him, your drinking is making me angry or scared or whatever the emotion was. I went to Laura and said, stop that. You know, and I'd try to shove words back in her mouth. Don't say that about your mother. You know, but I couldn't do it. I could not control this child. Now, I need to tell you that as I was growing up, my daddy was my god for a while. And then Bill became my god for a while. And then Laura became my god. I was sitting in a meeting one time, and this little insight came. Somebody said, your god is whatever you think about most during the day. And I was thinking about Laura. I was trying to figure out how to fix this child. Well, in the spring of 1985, Laura had to have jaw surgery. She had a very protruding chin. When you looked at her from the front, she was beautiful. But if she turned sideways, she had a chin that came. And so when she would sing in her choir, sometimes her mouth would lock open. So they went in and they cracked her jawbone and they slid it back and then they wired her mouth shut. We were so excited about that wired mouth shut part. Didn't do any good. She could still talk to us. But, you know, we're there for this major surgery for our daughters, and my husband isn't there. And it's 6:30 in the morning, and the director of my school, I had gone back to teaching, and the director of my school was there, and Bill wasn't. And it was the first time that I started to think, you know what? Things aren't quite right here. It's kind of like I'm doing this marriage and this family all by myself. I don't think this is how it should be. And so I started to pay attention. And I started watching him and thinking about what he was doing. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. All I knew was that I was watching him drink more, and I was feeling more alone all the time. And as that spring and that summer progressed, Bill progressed. The disease of the alcohol kind of went into his tissues. He just kind of puffed up like a little toad. It was kind of like if you stuck a pin in him, he'd go pshh. And he wasn't fat. It was just a puffiness. And I was watching that, and I was exhausted. I was crying. I couldn't get him to stop drinking. I couldn't get Laura to behave. You know, Wesley would get mad when he took out the trash, and I'd say, there's no need to be angry. I just ask you to take out the trash. Now today, I wish I have another way of doing it. When he take out the trash, he gets angry. I say, you know what? I can see that you're angry, and I need for you to take out the trash. Validate the feeling. Instead of, there's no need to feel the way you feel, don't feel that way. I hope I don't do... I'm so sad that I did that to my children. That's what was done to me, and it's kind of like what you're feeling and who you are not okay. So as the summer of 85 gets on in our ways, I'm watching Bill, and he'll come in from work, and he will say, what's for dinner? And I would tell him, and about 10 minutes later, he'd come in and ask what was for dinner. And I started thinking, really, that there was a brain tumor. I started wondering, what on earth is going on with this man? He's puffy. He'd say, let's go to the movies tonight. And I would get so excited, and I'd wash those dishes, and then I'd go in, and he'd be passed out on the bed. He was not participating in our family at all. And if he was awake, he never was sober. He was drinking from the time he got up in the morning till the time he went to bed. And, you know, when I got to the program, and I looked at step two, and it talks about that insanity, my sponsor had trouble with that because she was not insane. I had no problem with that because I started thinking about what I was doing. I was so obsessed with Bill's drinking that he would go in to take a shower at night. I would get my flashlight. He drove a pickup truck. I would go out to the pickup truck. He had a little brown paper sack. In that sack, he kept his vodka bottle. While he was showering, I would put the flashlight on that vodka bottle. If the level was high, I would go back in and be loving and caring and affectionate. If the level was low, I was sullen and quiet, you know. And I was judging my emotions by the level of a liquid on a bottle. That's not right, Bright, not real sane. And after we got into the program, he said, Stephanie, it was a different bottle every day. And I didn't know that, but he was drinking a fifth of vodka every day. And I was just, and I knew something was wrong. And I was watching myself, and I was completely exhausted, and I made a decision that I couldn't do it anymore. I said to him, I love you too much to watch you kill yourself with alcohol. And so I said, you either need to get out or get sober. I don't know what else to, you know, what are we going to do? This family, we're dying here. And so he left angrily, but he left, and I was so grateful. And one of his friends from work called because nobody knew Bill was an alcoholic. I'm telling you, this man of mine could just walk in front of a mirror and will himself to act sober. And after he got in the program, he told me that for the last year of his drinking, he went every morning and prayed to not drink that day, and he couldn't do it. But when I called my family and said, you know, I've asked Bill to leave or get sober, and my dad said, is he bringing home a paycheck? Is he showing up every night? What is your problem? You know, and that's the way my family, they didn't see him drunk. But I knew something was terribly wrong. So after he did leave, and one of his buddies from work called and said, you know, I have a place that I think you might enjoy going. And I was so wiped out, I would have done anything. And Jerry said, I'm a member of AA, and there is a group called Al-Anon, and I'd like to take you to one of their meetings. And I went July 24th, 1985. I almost want to cry when I say that date because I'm so grateful because I'm alive today because he did that. So I went to that meeting, and I cried just like this at every meeting for a whole year. I just was so tired of trying to keep the world together and trying to hold this family together, trying to love a man that really was unlovable, and trying to be okay. And I was teaching school, and I would, you know, I would go every day and try to do school and then come home and try to put the family together, and I was exhausted. I was literally exhausted. When I was crying, and after I'd gotten to the program and I got a sponsor, and I said to her, why can't I stop crying? And she said, you are grieving the loss of a dream. And I thought, oh, yeah. I never intended for our family to end up like this. I wasn't supposed to marry an alcoholic. I wasn't supposed to have a raging daughter and this son that's just doing the best he can to, you know, my little clown, my little happy child. And I really did. I was grieving the loss of a dream. But 2 weeks after Bill left and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, he had tried to sober himself up. He had been living with a friend of ours, and he called me and he said, I can't do it anymore. So Bill's sobriety date's August the 6th of 1985. 2 weeks after I came into Al-Anon, he came into AA. And I am telling you, we really, it was like, they talk about that pink cloud, you know. I don't know anything about a pink cloud. What I know was for the first time in my life, in my adult life, somebody was saying to me, we love you, we care about you, and we want you to take care of yourself. Let them take care of him. We want you to take care of yourself. They said, we want you to go to meetings and we want you to read the literature and, oh yes, get a sponsor. And I did. I got a jewel. I mean, it's all a God thing. It's all a God thing. Blanche is her name. And Blanche started loving me into wellness. She would wipe my tears when I cried. She would hold my hands and be happy for me. And she hugs you. When Blanche hugs you, you feel it down in your toes. And she started changing my God view. I didn't have this. She started saying to me, Stephanie, God only does good. He doesn't do bad. And I'd say, but our family is falling apart. And she would say, you have a disease. Your family is suffering from the disease of alcoholism. The whole family. God didn't punish you. This is a family disease. And then we started walking through the steps. And I started going to meetings. And Bill was going to his meetings. And we'd come out after the meetings. And he'd say, what was your topic? And I'd say, honesty, what was yours? And he'd say, 11th step. I said, what'd you think? And I mean, it was just a real beginning of communication, a growing and a healing. And I got back the man that I always knew was there. And I appreciate that from AA. And then Al-Anon started saying to me, you know, you better do a 4-step. You better get to work on yourself. You're going to have to make some changes here. And by the way, you may have a character defect or two. I said, I could hardly wait to do a 4-step. You know, in Al-Anon, they ask us to write a life story. Some Al-Anons do. And so I'm going to write and tell you how good I have been. And, you know, I could hardly wait to get that pen and paper. I was so excited. And I started writing, and I want you to know that I, you know, was not really healthy coming into that marriage, you know, and I was blaming it all on him and blaming it all on Laura. So we had an opportunity now to start the recovery. And while we are doing this, our daughter is still out there spinning around. I mean, she's 2 months from graduating in her senior year in high school. We've had to, you know, ground her. We've put her on restriction. We've done everything we can to try to get her to follow the rules. And so one night she was on curfew and she was supposed to be home at a certain time and she didn't come home. And she didn't come home the next day. And she didn't come home the next day. So I called Blanche and said, okay, what do I do now? And she says, well, I think it's time to pray. And I said, well, I think I need to call the cops. She says, no, we're going to pray. So I started working with Blanche. And Bill started working with his sponsor. And we tried to decide, what do you do for a child who was growing up in an alcoholic home who's doing all this raging? I've never seen Laura take a drink. It wasn't alcoholism. You know, it was just these behavior patterns that were just so out of control. So I went to an Al-Anon meeting one time, and I was just going on, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know where my daughter is. I don't know how we're going to take care of this. And somebody said, so what would you be doing if this weren't happening? And I said, well, you don't understand. We've got to find Laura, and there's got to be consequences. You know, but what would you be doing if this weren't happening? And they kept saying that to me. And I finally said, well, I have a sink full of dirty dishes. And they said, good, go home and wash your dirty dishes. And so I was getting into my car one day after class. Laura had been gone 3 or 4 days. And it was one of those God moments. I opened the door, and it was as if I had this little message that said, if what you're doing hasn't worked, why don't you try something different? Wow. Okay. So Laura calls on Friday. She's been gone since Sunday. As if nothing has happened. Hey, Mom, I'm coming home this afternoon, and I need for you to tape this baseball game because I'm afraid I'm going to miss it. And I went, Laura, I love you, and you can't come home. Now, this is a mom, you know, who loves and wants to take care of these children. And it was a God thing. It was a real graced moment. I wasn't crying. I wasn't upset. I was very peaceful. And she said, "What?" And I said, "I love you and you can't come home." Now, she's 2 months from graduating from high school. And to me, graduating from high school is very important. And so I try very hard to get her to that. But they had said to me, if you keep enabling and there aren't any consequences for her choices, what will the child learn? You know what? My children never had consequences for their choices. I always said things like, "Well, we'll see. Well, maybe. I don't know." You know, and finally they said, "There need to be some consequences here." So I told her, "I love you and you can't come home." Well, she was a little bit angry, slammed down the phone, and I went to my Al-Anon meeting the next morning crying, you know, what is going to happen, and, you know, and called Blanche, and Blanche said, "It's okay. She's got a God that loves her more than you do." And I went, "Oh my gosh." And Blanche said, "She does. Her God loves you more than you." So I tried to release Laura, and during this time, my husband was just adamant that she needed treatment. So we found a treatment center for Laura that would take care of her behavioral problems. So she was gone a month, and I asked Blanche if I could please call her. She was on the streets. She was beat up. But I also knew a friend that she had contact with, so I called her friend, and Laura was there, and I said, "Laura, I want to tell you that I love you, and if you ever want the help, we know where you can get it." And you know her response, "What do I have to do?" You know, "Well, we'll pick you up in the morning." And we did, and we took her to treatment. And she calls 2 days later, and she's 2 days later, and she says, "Mom, how would you feel about me being an alcoholic?" And I said, "Whatever 12-step program you want to latch on to is fine with me, girlfriend." And so, sure enough, during this time when she's doing all this acting out, she was drinking alcoholically. She's 17 years old, and she's drinking alcoholically, and I never saw her take a drink. So she went to the treatment center, and we went for family week, and we're getting ready to bring her home, and she has this little rage problem that they feel like needs a little more attention, so she ends up going to a halfway house in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm going to Blanche crying, saying, "I don't think I can let her go, you know." And Blanche says, "This is beautiful. God's will never take you where his grace will not sustain you." And it was God's will for Laura to be in that halfway house. After she was there 4.5 months, we went to pick her up and bring her home. Not only did she graduate from high school by correspondence, she became a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and was given a 12-step program to live the rest of her life by. You know, I saw this little picture of the puzzle. Let's just get her out of high school, please. And God said, "Yeah, I think we'll do better than that." And here was this now sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so now Bill and Laura and I are all going to open AA meetings, and you know, we're holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer, which I cannot believe. Bill was an agnostic. It's beautiful. And Bill comes home one day, and we're in Austin, Texas, and he says, "You know what, how would you feel about moving to Virginia?" I said, "Sure, we can do that." I didn't think he ever would. And he said, "I'm tired of traveling." And he said, "And I would like to be able to not travel. The kids are gone now." And so he said, let's move to Virginia. So I was scared to go, but AAs came over to our house and Al-Anons, and they said, "You know what you've got in Austin? Let's go see what's up in Reston, Virginia." Meanwhile, I need to tell you about this son of mine. He had a problem when he was a senior in high school. He did graduate on time, thank you, God. But he was also trying to play football, and he was getting all of his affirmation from outside. So he was a baseball player and a football player, and he played soccer, and he's going to get affirmed by the outside because he had that hole just like his mama. You know, and so he'd been lifting weights, and he was going to be on that football field, and he got viral meningitis. And he was in the hospital with 104 temperature for 7 days. And I didn't think I could stand it, and I called Blanche and said, "Blanche, if anything happens to this boy, I will die." And she said, "No, you won't." And I said, "But why is God doing this to us? We are walking a spiritual path. We're sponsoring, being sponsored, going to meetings. Laura's sober. I don't understand. This kid's never done anything to hurt anybody." And Blanche said, "Once again, God doesn't do these things. Your son has a virus." And so the difference was, when Wes was in the hospital, I had a sober husband praying with me and crying with me. And Wes did get well. he lost all of his body fat, and he was out there trying to get that affirmation from those sports still, even after that. But, you know, it was one more time when I had to be reminded that this God of mine was too small. And he did bad. And, I have to keep coming to the meeting so y'all can keep saying things to me like, Stephanie, your God's too small. You need a bigger God. Our God doesn't do bad. You know, it's a disease. So I learned a lot. And anyway, Wes does graduate. He moves out of the house. Bill decides that if it's okay with me, we're going to go to Reston, Virginia. And we move up there, and sure enough, they have Al-Anon in Reston, Virginia, and AA. They didn't do it right, but... and I tried to tell them, which they only listened to a few times. They were a little put out with me. And so... I found a group that was loving and caring and supportive of me. And this is all such good news for me. And after we had been there for not quite a year, we get a phone call from Laura. And she says, Mom, I just had to go pick up Wes. And I said, why? He's a freshman in college. And she says, well, he got really sick because he drank too much. Oh, God, no. And so Wesley went to his first AA meeting. This year, my daughter has 14 years of sobriety, and my son has 10 years of sobriety. And I'm telling you, if that's not a God thing, you know. So we have a family in recovery, and I am so grateful. But my son did not call his mama. You know, he called his sister. He knew where to go for help. We talk about detachment all the time in Al-Anon, and for me to detach, you have to put my husband in a treatment center. You have to put my daughter in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and to get my son sober, you have to move me from Texas to Reston, Virginia. That's how I detach. I just don't do that principle very well. But if you get everybody sober, I'm okay. Because then I think they have a support system. I messed them up. And that's truly the way I look at it now. You know, whenever my daughter or son call, it's like, you know, I love you, and I know that must be rough, and have you called your sponsor? You know, when was the last time you went to a meeting? And my daughter's home is just filled with AA, and they have meetings there all the time. So it's really a neat thing. So now Wes is sober, and, you know, Bill and I are kind of like on a second honeymoon. We are really enjoying being in Virginia. And I've gone back to teaching in a little private school, which I loved, and we were having a very good time. And we get a phone call from our daughter, and she's 5 years sober, and she says, Mom, I'm going to have a baby. And I said, no, you're not. And she said, yes, I am. And I said, you can't. And she said, why not? And I said, because we didn't have a wedding. I said, first you have the wedding, and then you have the baby. She says, no, Mom. She says, I'm going to have a baby. I was furious. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. And I was mad at you. She'd been sober 5 years. Had y'all not taught her anything? You know, and it was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had been dating him, and it was like, and I was so embarrassed, and I felt like it was such a horrible thing that I would not tell anybody. It was just like, I can't believe this is just terrible. Well, I finally had the courage to share with one of my Al-Anon friends, and I said, Rita, guess what? My daughter's going to have a baby. She said, oh. And I said, no, this is horrible. And she said, why? I said, because she's not married. And she said, and so you think it's horrible to have a baby without the wedding? And I said, yes, I do. She said, so you're labeling this as being bad? And I said, yes, it's very bad. And she said, I wonder if you could just call it, that's what is. This is just what is. So I finally got up the courage to share at my Al-Anon group, and people are coming up going to me, go, oh, yeah, well, my son wasn't married, and we've got you. Well, needless to say, on June the 6th of 1992, the most beautiful baby in the entire world was born. Her name is Stephanie Grace. She was beautiful. And Bill was there sober. Wesley was there sober. I was there a wreck, but emotionally sober. And you know what? We didn't need a wedding, and we didn't need a daddy. You know, we had the love and the caring, and I was so unhappy with myself for judging that. You know, when I talked earlier about character defects, I hate to tell you that I have a few, and judgmental is one of them. You know, every time my husband took a drink, I never said he may be suffering from a disease. I always said, what is the matter with that poor, you know, individual? I always judged him and found him lacking. And here's a situation where we've got this beautiful grandbaby, and I had said no. Oh, I'm so sorry that I did that. Grace is now 9 years old, and she's beautiful. She is putting her mother to shame. She has got the little gene, and it's just kind of raging and raring. When she was in second grade, the teacher asked all the children to please stand up and introduce themselves. And each child was doing that. And my little Grace stood up, and she said, "Hi, my name is Grace, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got 7 years of sobriety." She didn't know any difference. She truly believed it, you know. Of course, the teacher was horrified, you know. And Grace, and so she calls Laura. Well, for, you know, the teacher went, "What'd you say?" And you know how this hands on the hip kind of thing? Laura did that. Grace does that, you know. "Didn't you hear what I said? I'm an alcoholic, and I've got 7 years of sobriety." And so she called, the teacher called Laura and said, "My gosh, what is going on?" And Laura said, "Oh, Grace isn't the alcoholic. I am." And the teacher went, "What?" And Laura said, no, I'm sober today. It's okay, you know. So Grace loves to go to the AA club. They have meetings. When somebody calls and Laura's busy, Grace will say, "Well, I think my mama's going to tell you to read this page in the big book." And she said, "And if you don't have, you know, if you need to go to a meeting," she says, "there's one at 5:30 at Northland." She says, "My mama's always there." And she really, this is what she does. Now, when Laura was a teenager, her favorite phrase was, "Whatever." That's what she would say, no matter what. I'd say, "Laura, it's time for dinner." And she'd go, "Whatever." You know, and then Grace's favorite phrase is, "Yeah, right." And so I got them T-shirts, and Laura's is "Whatever," and Grace's is "Yeah, right." You know, it's wonderful. And I love to listen to Laura. "Mama, guess what Grace did?" And I just sit on the phone going, "Oh, honey." You know, because it really, you know, I was such a villain. I was the one that was, and now we're finding out that it's part of trying to raise a kid, you know, and they have a personality, by golly, and a mind of their own. So we have Grace now, and I am thrilled to death, and she's a tiny little beautiful thing that we just love so much. And then I get a call, and my dad has passed away. He had an aneurysm in his belly, and it ruptured. This is in 1993. And only as much as I missed him, and what a shock it was for me at the time. The good news was I had done steps 8 and 9. We were clean and clear. My sister and brother don't have a program, and they are resentful today at my dad. And I knew, I was so grateful that I had taken the time to go to Daddy and make amends. So I knew that even though there was the, you know, the loss, there was also the gratitude. Now I have to tell you the part of my story that always is hard for me. But if you'll bear with me, I'll make it through this, because I always do. My husband had trouble accepting his humanness. You know, I think that when we have these character defects, we hold them up to the light. And then we try to get a little bit of help from somebody who's also suffered. Bill suffered from depression. And in February of 1994, Bill committed suicide. And I want you to know that it took every Al-Anon meeting, every page in the literature that I had ever read, every visit with my sponsor, for me to be able to make it through. People had said to me, "So you had an idea, right?" No. This husband of mine and I had been to the grocery store and out to dinner the night before. I didn't have an idea. Bill had a disease, and in my opinion, depression will kill you if it goes untreated. And Bill had been on antidepressants long before, but he had taken himself off of them because things had leveled out. And he had a hole in his belly that the psychiatrist has explained to me is not just like my hole or Libba's hole. His hole was black. It was black. And he needed more help. And he needed to reach out and ask for it. And he didn't do it.
We had a service for him in Virginia, and this little chapel was filled with my teacher friends, his work friends, and the AA and Al-Anon families. My teacher friend said to me later, "Who were all those people? You know, y'all had only lived here 4 years, and I've never seen a turnout like that." And I said, "Oh, that's my family. And you were there for me." And I have to tell you this. I don't often say this, but it just popped into my brain. The day Bill died on February the 28th, and on March the 1st, it snowed in Virginia. And one of the guys that Bill sponsored, I looked out the window, and I hadn't slept. I hadn't eaten. And this guy, his name's Chris, he was shoveling my sidewalk. He didn't come in and ask me how I was. He didn't bring me anything. He just did the service work that he knew I needed. And he never said a word. We've never talked about it. He just shoveled the snow off the sidewalk. We brought Bill back to Texas, and we had an AA ceremony at the gravesite, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I really didn't know how I was going to put one foot in front of the other. But you know, Blanche was holding my hand, and every time I'd get a little weakness and I'd call her, and it was as if she would touch my face and say, "It's going to be okay. You're going to be okay." And I think if you ask my children today about their mom, they would say this one thing to you: she doesn't quit. She just doesn't quit. And that's what I did. And I thought, he died, I didn't. And you have given me a program of recovery and life to live by. And that's what I decided to do. I stayed in Virginia for 2 more years because I had a job in a school that I loved. And my children kept saying, "Come home, Mama, please come home." And I didn't. A year after Bill died, both of my children married. And Laura was a little late, but a counselor explained to me that when a family is destroyed as ours was like that, they find a need. Children my children's ages, they were in their 20s, they found a need to recreate the family unit. So Laura got married in April of 95, and Wesley got married in August of 95. This same counselor that I went to see shared with me that it may be a practice marriage for them, because they just needed to recreate this unit, and it might not be the love of their lives. And sure enough, both of those marriages were practice marriages. I am so grateful for counseling, you know. I mean, I believe in the Al-Anon thing, but when you need it, this counselor explained to me the difference between grief and trauma. And you know, grief is loss, and it's devastating. Trauma is when, in a split second, your life changes and will never be the same again. And she explained to me how important it was that I understand that I had been traumatized by Bill's suicide. She says, things like that, it takes a while to just get back on your feet again. And things were happening around me. I was forgetting things, and I hyperventilated in the grocery store, and I'd never hyperventilated in my life. I mean, things that make you think you're crazy, and you're not, you're grieving. And I was traumatized. So I kept on teaching. I was actually a director in this school, but I was missing Grace a lot. And so I decided that I needed to come back to Texas. And so when Bill had died, during his life, in all those years he worked so hard, he had invested in some different things. And so he had left a sum of money. And you know what? I don't care about money. I didn't then, and I don't today. But I want to tell you, I should have. I invested this money with somebody that wasn't trustworthy. And so in the process, while I was getting ready to leave Virginia, somebody said to me, "So where are you going? Are you going back to Austin?" And I said, "No, in the few years I've been gone, 6 years, it's gotten too big." I said, "I want to go live somewhere where I'm on a lake." I said, "I love water. And I want to be able to watch the sunset." Because in Virginia, the trees are so tall, you never get to see a sunset. Texas sunsets are beautiful. And I've never lived in a new house in my life. I would love to live in a new house. So I moved back to Texas. I'm in this beautiful house. I'm on Lake LBJ. The sun sets over Pack Saddle Mountain. It is gorgeous.
And I can't, you know, it was kind of like just a thought I had. And so after I'd gotten back to Texas, I called this guy that had my money and said to him, you know, I would appreciate you sending it down here to Merrill Lynch, because my idea was I'm going to travel and go to AA and Al-Anon things, and I'm going to go, you know, play with Grace, and, you know, and he said, okay. And there was no money. Bruce had spent $350,000, and so everything I had was gone. And I want you to know that's like another death. It's like another loss. I mean, I could not believe it. And but you know what? It's also, I have a responsibility here. I did not care about the money. I was in such a state of shock, and I was so overwhelmed with all the stuff that was happening that if he told me to sign my name, by golly, I did, because I trusted him. The sad thing was he wasn't trustworthy. So I moved back to this house, and now I've got a house payment, and I need some money. And so the only thing I've ever known how to do is teach school. So I start praying. And every time anybody would come up to me and say, how are you doing? I would think about Bruce, and I would get, I'd almost cry. So I did what y'all said, and I started praying for Bruce. And I want you to know, to this day, every single morning I pray for Bruce and his family. They did. I did file charges, and he is in prison today. He's serving another year, and then he'll be out, and he's ordered to make restitution. But the judge says, don't count on anything. He's got three kids. They need to go to school, you know. But, so, you know, I don't, whatever happens to Bruce, it's okay with me today. I'm so sorry that he could do that to somebody in my, you know, circumstances. It's life. You know, let's not call it bad. Let's just say it's what is. And it is. It's what is. And so I start trying to find a job. Well, they built a school 7 minutes from my house. And sure enough, a first grade teacher wants to retire. Now, when I moved to Texas, I didn't think I'd ever teach school again, so I gave away all my stuff. Well, this teacher that wanted to retire doesn't want any of her stuff, and so she asked me if I'd just please walk into her room and start teaching. And I am doing that. I am teaching first grade in a little town called Granite Shoals, which is about an hour and a half northwest of Austin. Laura lives in Austin. She has remarried a really nice fella named Jamie, all sober members of AA. Wes is going to get married again. Oh, yeah. Lib and I were talking today about how these sons of ours that are so smart and so put together, and then they call one day and go, you know this college thing? Well, I think I'm going to stop now. Wes had 18 hours left to get a degree in criminal justice, and he's done. He doesn't want to do that anymore. And so he went up and worked on a ranch in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and then he's training Arabian horses in Alpharetta, Georgia, and now he's in Chicago. And, you know, thank you, God, that I know you love him. You've got a path. I don't have to be responsible. I pray nonstop for these children of mine. But you know what? Our family is in recovery. These yucky things that have happened to us are just part of being alive and being human. And thank goodness the message you gave me was, Stephanie, you don't ever have to do this deal alone again, ever. You don't ever have to be alone again. There will be somebody to answer that phone or to hold your hand. And that's been true for me. Wes is going to get married on September the 8th. And to a really nice girl who's not in any program. Oh, yeah, we were talking about that word yet. Isn't that a great word? You know, yet. It kind of doesn't have an ending for this, you know. Now then, as I want to finish my story for you today, I need to tell you one thing. This sponsor of mine that has loved me unconditionally, first time anybody has ever just touched my face and said, it's okay to be who you are and how you are. I love you anyway. She would be really proud of me today because I have on hose and heels. She was very proper. But she walked with me through everything. And she would get angry at Laura for me because I just always cried. You know, she'd say, does that make you angry? And I go, no, it just hurt my feelings. And she'd say, well, it would have made me angry. And then I started thinking, oh, yeah, I guess I should have gotten angry at that. But she's been with me all this many times. And Blanche had an accident in September. And she was in the hospital for 6 weeks. And prior to this,
She and I have been praying because I have a little red Oldsmobile that is 10 years old and has over 110,000 miles on it. And my little school teacher pay will not make a car payment. And Blanche has been entering sweepstakes for me. She tries really hard to get me to win, and she'll call and she'll say, okay, Stephanie, this is a Jeep. Are you going to be okay driving a Jeep? I'll say, yes, Blanche, I can drive a Jeep. She'll say, okay, I'm sending in. Then she calls and she says, now you've got a red car. Do you want another red car? I say, yes, I want a red car. She says, okay, check off that red. And so Blanche was entering this sweepstake for me. And after her accident, she was in the hospital for 7 weeks. And I would go and see her. I would teach school during the week. And then on the Saturday, I would drive to Temple, which was about an hour and a half. And every time I'd get there, she'd say, is your car okay? I say, yeah, Blanche, it made it. Every time I'd get in that little car, I'd say, okay, just get me from here to there, please. And then I'd get there and I'd go, thank you, God. And then get me from here to there, thank you, God. And I started worrying about it. And then I started getting mad at Bruce again because he took away my choices, by golly. And then I got to a place where it was like, you know what? This God of mine is so big and so good, there is no way he's going to leave me stranded. He will somehow, there will be something, and it will be okay. And I stopped worrying about it, but Blanche kept on worrying about it. And so the sadness for me is that Blanche did not recover from her injuries. And I had another loss to deal with. We had been together for 15 years, and I loved her, and I felt loved by her in a way that those of you that have a sponsor would know what I'm talking about. And so we had a memorial service for her, and they had asked me to talk at the service. And so my daughter calls, and she says, Mom, I'm going to be there in Temple with you this morning. And I said, well, good, Laura. And she says, you are going to tell them how Blanche is responsible for our family and recovery, aren't you? I said, Laura, you hated Blanche. And she said, because Blanche would say, hold that child accountable. Do not accept unacceptable behavior. You know, all Laura knew was unacceptable behavior. And so I said, Laura, you hated Blanche. And she said, oh, Mom, not now. If it weren't for Blanche, I might not be sober today. The power of the Al-Anon program. And Blanche was willing to sit with me and hold my hand and love me through all of this. So we had some, I stood up and I was so grateful that Laura was there because I could share with everybody. And you know what? There are people that are sober today because Blanche was a member of Al-Anon family groups for over 34 years. And she was willing to share. She had been dead about a month and her daughter called me and she said, I've been really worried. And she said, I keep waking up in the middle of the night. And she said, it's like my mom and God are talking to me. And I said, yeah. And she said, yeah. And she said, and I have to tell you, I think Mom and God want you to have my mom's car. Blanche was driving a 99 Cadillac. Had 23,000 miles on it, and it's all paid for. Well, I said, you know, I can't take that car. And she said, well, you're going to have to argue with my mother and God because I really do believe that to be true. And so Laura and Jamie drove me to Blanche's house. I get in that car every day and feel hugged and loved by her. But you know what I want to share with you today? Don't ever limit God. You know, I just wanted my daughter to graduate from high school. I just wanted enough to make a car payment. You know, and God said, no, have a luxury car. Oh, yes, it costs a lot to put the gasoline in it, but it's a lot less than a car payment. You know, and I feel hugged and loved. And I think, you know, aren't I sad that I would have limited God? And I have done that so many times. There are a few things that I've learned over the years. My daughter has a phrase now. I just love Laura. Oh, my gosh. She says to me all the time, you know, Mom, everything is not about you. Because I'll call, and Laura's pattern for all of her life has been, hi, Mom, gotta go. You know, and she never says, how are you?
you know. So now I'm taking my turn. And so when she calls and she, you know, will say, well, so how's it going? I tell her, you know, and every once in a while she'll say, you know, everything's not about you. But we laugh about it now. It's kind of a family thing. But every morning now, I walk out of my door and I say, God, please help me remember that today it's not about me. And it's not. I finally sort of get the idea. This is a God deal. He's working through me. And I'm just supposed to show up and love some of his kids just a little bit. But it's not about me. It's about God. My son also never leaves the house without getting on his knees. He came and visited for a couple of weeks in June, and we talked and talked and talked. Oh, he's such a fine young man. He doesn't need a piece of paper to tell me that, but I forget that. And Wesley says, Mom, you know what? I never leave the house without getting on my knees. And I said, Wesley, I didn't know that about you. He said, oh, yeah. He said, even if I'm running late. So every morning I get on my knees and say, God, please help me remember this is not about me. This is about you, and I want your will, not mine. Let's go see if we can do this deal together today. And that's truly what I pray for. And it's amazing to me that I, you know, can kind of show up, and every once in a while I get a gift. Not every once in a while, every day is a gift for me. And look where I am today. Oh, my gosh. You know, Alatoona. I went on a boat ride, and it was wonderful. So I want to thank you. I want you to know that anything that you heard today is nothing original with me other than all my little life's events, because I showed up and I paid attention and you shared with me, and I have been given the opportunity to share with you, and I so appreciate you listening. Thank you.